I don't actually want the work to be easier. I don't want the work to be done for me. This is the work that I signed up for, right? I signed up to do the planning and to do the thinking about how to help kids understand how to multiply fractions. That's the joy of the job. It should be. And I don't want a tool to do that for me. I want my employers to change the material conditions such that I'm able to do my job. Stop giving me more bullshit to do. Don't offer me a tool to do the bullshit. Just take away the bullshit.
Welcome to Politics, a show where two software developers break the fourth wall and talk about the interlacing of technology and politics. I'm Josh.
And I'm Ray. We see technologies like crypto, AI, and surveillance infecting our politics. Meanwhile, governments and the media are making out that all this is inevitable. We can't leave the future in the hands of scheming technology leaders and their pet politicians.
We're here to raise our voice and open up the space for honest, good faith discussions. To help us organize and sharpen our ideas, we've invited some interesting and highly respected thinkers to share their understanding and their research with us and, of course, with you.
Politics is where we smash the myths and get to the truth.
Ray, we need to talk about education.
Yeah, well, I'd like to learn something about that.
I bet you would. I bet you would. Should we see if we can get an educator on to help you learn good them stuffs?
Well, things and stuffs. Yeah, let's try and do that because we need to learn those things.
Excellent. I reached out to Nate Madsen-Dion and he agreed to come on to edumacate us both about the dangers of AI in schools. So Nate, thank you for joining us and would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. My name is Nate Madsen-Dion. I am a fifth grade teacher in Aurora, Colorado.
Very cool. The Mile High State, as they call it, right? Or at least something.
Mile High City, yeah.
Mile High City, there you go. Yeah. All right. It's been a while since I've lived in the U.S., as listeners can now tell. So yeah, Nate, we wanted to talk to you tonight about technology in the classroom, specifically what's called AI recently. But, you know, we could go further afield than that, because really what we're talking about, I guess, is the kind of project of big tech and how that's entering the education space. So maybe just give us a kind of survey of what you're seeing in your school these days.
Absolutely. So this is actually my 25th year teaching. So I've seen a whole range. I've seen technologies come in and out in all that time. I've been in my current district for about 10 years. And even in that time, have seen us go from, you know, a couple laptop carts here and there, a lab of desktop computers, things like that, to now we have one-to-one devices in every classroom. Most classes have Chromebooks. Younger grades sometimes use iPads, but every class has a full set of devices for students. And, you know, I think as that first came in, I was pretty excited about it, right? Lots of opportunities for kids and lots of ways to use different technologies. You know, I think it's important for kids to learn to type and to write on the computer and kinds of things like that. And so we didn't have to plan a time to make that happen, right? You could just write when it was time to write. And what I've seen is that the technology that gets used, all of the ed tech programs and things like that, are just kind of crap. I don't think there's any of them. I'm like, yeah, this is really good. You know, we currently use a program called iReady that is has reading and math lessons. It's got little cartoon characters that do the lessons and whatever. And, you know, especially once kids are in fifth grade, they hate it. Right. It's boring. It's slow. It, I think a lot of people think, basically can do what teachers do. And it obviously can't. And kids know that. Kids would prefer to not be on technology. I'm starting to find, you know, we actually last year had some sort of attack on our district systems that led to all of our technology being completely shut down for a week.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, I mean, everything was completely shut down. Internet was shut down, which meant we couldn't copy or print because everything's connected to the internet. Our phone systems are all through the internet, so we couldn't make phone calls from classroom phones. And the thing that I actually found was that kids loved it and were dismayed to hear that the internet came back after a week or so. It was really easy for me. I mostly teach math, and we have paper resources for math, right? We have math books. And so it was very easy for me to just continue. You know, I use some Google Slides and things like that for, you know, presenting some things to the class, and I could use my own hotspot and whatever to do some of that. So I still had that access, but yeah, kids every single day were like, "It's not back, is it?" And I was like, "Nope, it's not back yet." And they're, "Okay, good. All right. And the day I came back, there were kids that were legitimately like, "No,
wow,
why?" You know, it was fascinating to see. And that, I think, really helped me sort of reframe some of my thinking about technology in the classroom. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it's a creep, right? Like, it's something that just kind of happens over and over again. And now you get this little thing, right? The introduction of one-to-one devices is like, well, yeah, obviously we have that because we need that, right? And then it turns out maybe we don't.
I mean, I guess you asked this question, but why were the kids happy? What was driving the, maybe it's the opposite. What's driving the unhappiness with the return of the internet?
Yeah, I think mostly they think it's boring. Programs we use, I think, you know, they also all, they have their own personal relationships with technology, right? Things they want to do on their phones or on their devices at home or their game systems or whatever. And I do think it's like, at some point it's like, but that's how I use the internet, right? I don't want to use the internet to do math.
Right. Yeah.
And again, like, the programs are boring. They are not super interesting. It's a task and a chore and all of this.
Right.
Instead of feeling meaningful, and you're not working with anybody else, right?
Mm.
I tell them all the time, like, you're supposed to be learning with other people, right? You are constantly going to be working with other people. You're not doing that if you're sitting on iReady by yourself.
Right.
You're sitting in a silent room of kids with headphones on and faces lit up by the glow of the screen, right? And that's that's not a joyful learning environment.
No.
And I think kids have really internalized that.
Do you still have like a whiteboard or a chalkboard or something that you can still draw with and like write out your explanations?
So my first year in my current classroom, there actually wasn't even a whiteboard in the room.
Mm.
And we also have, they're called box lights, but it's a, you know, a giant smart board.
Mm.
There's a giant TV. And so I was using that as the tool for that. But then after that first year, I said, you know, I really need some whiteboards in this room.
Mm-hmm.
And so got them to add a couple of whiteboards. So yes, so now I do have whiteboards, and there's a lot of times when we're, you know, doing something as a whole class, and I'll like have something on the smart board, but then I'm like, all right, now let's like do this thing over here on the whiteboard and like see how it works.
That's really hard to fathom. I mean, we're both programmers, and I think, Ray, you've been working remotely for quite some time, right?
Yeah, probably. It's coming up probably for 10 years, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm a lot more recent to the world of full-time remote first working. And one of the things that I miss the most is honestly just a whiteboard. It's so great to be in person with people and be, you know, solving problems together, like physically writing on something. Mm. And I find, yeah, of course, there are digital replacements for that or digital alternatives, but they are not, in fact, you know, a true replacement.
Yeah, it's never the same. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
It's so interesting. Like you said, you teach fifth grade, and I have a good friend who's also a fifth grade teacher. And in their classroom, I think they have iPads, but that's a relatively recent development. And it kind of, do you know what the genesis of that was in your school? Like, who decided this was a good idea, that the kids needed devices and apps for learning, etc.?
It's district-wide for us. It's the district initiative to have one-to-one in every classroom. And I think really, it was just like, this is what we have to do, right? 21st century skills, all that sort of mostly nonsense, right? I think having some fluency with technology is good, right? Like over-reliance on it is very bad. I remember in my previous school, at one point, my principal was essentially saying, like, let's get these bookshelves out of the classroom. Let's get these books out of the classroom because everything can be done digitally. And I was like, absolutely fucking not. Yeah. Like, I will never get rid of my books, right? Like, I will not do that under any circumstances. And you know, he was like, okay, okay, you're right. But like, most of it can be done online. And I was like, should it though? Can and should are very different things.
Yeah, yes. Until some hero who is doing, you know, King Lud's work takes the internet out for a week.
Exactly. Although, it's not really germane to the point, but my big concern is it was shortly after Trump's inauguration. And I heard somebody say, and I think it's probably reasonable speculation, that it had to do with like trying to get at student records. I live in a district that has a huge immigrant population. And so while we haven't had nearly as much of the kind of activity that Minneapolis has had or LA or places like that, it's a real fear in our community. And I wonder if that wasn't who was behind that.
Very interesting. And not completely separate from AI and big tech, as it turns out, right?
Not at all, yeah.
So we were talking, you know, kind of about technology in general. Have you started to see things like chatbots and other, you know, quote unquote AI technology being introduced into the school, like either in the classroom or, you know, maybe in the kind of administration, that sort of function?
Yeah, it's definitely started to creep in. My first experience with any of that was working on a committee. We were trying to write a statement about something. And a friend of mine said, oh, like, I'll just put all these statements that we're trying to synthesize into ChatGPT and it'll like come up with a statement for us. And it did. And I was like, huh, like, that's interesting. And I started reading about it and I was like, huh, like, I'm not going to do that. And, you know, it is definitely, I think last year, maybe they rolled out Magic School for educators in the district, which I just recently learned is like a Claude-based program that's supposed to be education focused, and they present themselves as like boutique AI. You know, we're not Google, right? We're just a couple of little guys, and
right. Artisanal, hand rolled.
Yeah, and so that's how it's been presented. And so, you know, you should use this for planning. And my school had a professional development about using Magic School for planning earlier this year. And my friend who had been the one who introduced it to me in the first place, and we'd had many conversations about it, and he knew my feelings on it at that point, said, I bet you're really looking forward to this professional development. And I said, yeah, I really am. I will not be participating in that. And my principal came over and said, you know, this other guy mentioned to me that you like weren't really interested in this. And I was like, I'm not interested. I'm not doing this under any circumstances. And she was like, that's fine. You know, like, I fortunately haven't had the experience yet where somebody's trying to tell me that I have to. Yeah. So that's been so far.
But Nate, was the principal interested in your rationale, or was it just, okay, I'll just leave it be? Or, you know, was there an actual substantive discussion around it, or was it kind of like, ooh, we've got a holdout here?
Yeah, I would say, like, I didn't take the opportunity to have a conversation with her about it, but I don't think she's uninterested. I think if, like, I took the opportunity and said, like, and here's why, you know, like, here's why I think this is bad. Like, and also, like, I think the thing that's hard about it is, you know, people are presented with this and they're like, oh, it's going to save me time and it's going to do all these other things, right? Because with everything AI, right, it's immediately, you know, if you don't know anything about it, all you see is like, this can make my work easier.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I'm always trying to find the right lane for the like critical conversation, right? Because, you know, I have colleagues who like saw that presentation and were like, oh, wow, like I want to use this, right? And it's like, okay, well, maybe this moment isn't the time to say, no, you shouldn't use that. But, you know, then you find ways to say like, oh yeah, like that's a reason I don't do this. Or here's this interesting article I found or whatever it is, right? You got to kind of like finesse it, which I think I've been doing. You know, I put up they give us an ed tech poster in our staff lounge, you know, once a month or once a quarter or whatever. And there was a recent one about using Gemini, and I typed up a little thing and drew a little arrow on it. And it was like, did you know, like every time you use Gemini, here's how much water it uses. And then Gemini owns your thoughts and whatever else. And just kind of stuck that up there. And it was up there for a couple weeks, and somebody took it down, and I put it back up, and somebody took it down.
Oh, I see. It's a Wikipedia thing going on here.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So yeah, somebody doesn't like the editorializing, I guess.
Yeah. Well, but I think the Gemini use is editorialized already. I mean, that's the thing that people kind of miss. But yeah, actually, as a friend of mine, he's a teacher and he uses ChatGPT to help him with his planning and with his marking even. And he was saying that from his perspective, it was pretty good because he could cut his like preparation time down from 4 hours to 1 hour. And the thing is that he knows that it makes loads of mistakes, but because he knows the subject very well,
yeah,
he can kind of like, he can grok it and like finesse it.
No pun intended, I hope there, Ray.
Oh God, no. I don't know if, I mean, I'm using grok in the school. Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah. Bad word.
Mecha Hitler involved, yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, it seems like some people, even like, I mean, this guy is like quite the lefty and, you know, it's quite the kind of smart person, in my opinion. But he's sort of seeing that it can be used for productivity and kind of eliding the downsides, you know, even though he's a relatively, like I say, sort of woke person, let's say, or kind of like alive to some of these issues.
I think the thing that's really hard about it is like, yes, like teachers are given too much to do.
Yeah.
You know, classes are too big. You know, all of these things are true, right? But what I've been sort of trying to center in conversations about this, I don't actually want the work to be easier. I don't want the work to be done for me. Like this is the work that I signed up for, yeah. Right? I signed up to do the planning and to do the thinking about how to help kids understand how to multiply fractions, right? That's the joy of the job. It should be.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I don't want a tool to do that for me. I want my employers to change the material conditions such that I'm able to do my job. Stop giving me more bullshit to do, right?
Yep.
Don't offer me a tool to do the bullshit. Just take away the bullshit.
100%. Yeah, I was getting ready to mention, you know, bullshit jobs like the David Graeber, I think, yep. Has a, you know, a kind of theoretical framework around bullshit jobs. And I mean, chatbots or generative AI, like this is perfect for bullshit because that's what they are, bullshit machines.
Yep.
But then when you look at lesson planning, I think if you're using a chatbot for that as an educator, you're basically saying, well, planning is bullshit. So I'll just automate it away. And it's like, you know, again, talking to my friends who are teachers, for them, like planning is where, you know, it's like problem solving because they're not just like building a lesson to teach generic people. They're actually thinking of the students in their class and they're like, well, I have these people who struggle, you know, with material presented this way. So I got to do this sort of thing. And I mean, you mentioned it yourself that you find that rewarding, like that's the job you signed up to. But, you know, my friend really, like the thing they said was they feel this is kind of keeping their mind sharp by having to do the lesson planning, you know, every week.
Yeah. And I think we are often asked to plan in ways that are bullshit. Some of the tasks we're asked to do around planning aren't inherently meaningful for kids or for the planning or for me.
Right.
right? It's checking a box. It's filling out a template. It's doing whatever, right? And there's no inherent meaning in that. It's been true my entire time in education. We do a terrible job of actually teaching people how to plan. It's one of the biggest faults in the education system in this country is people never really learn how to plan, right? I actually did student teaching twice. I did it in my undergrad, did student teaching. Nowhere in there did I really learn how to plan beyond planning like a single lesson, right? You get lots of practice in planning one amazing lesson, right? But, you know, to plan for, you know, an entire unit and all of the things that come along with that, there's a real lack of efficiency in figuring out how to plan for that and all of the other things. So if you have to do that, right, and if there's something that somebody says, hey, like, this will do some of that for you so you don't have to worry about it, I see the appeal.
Sure.
But again, ultimately, like, I understand what I'd be taking away from myself and from my kids in doing that. And I think a lot of people aren't seeing that part yet.
So without getting too much into the weeds, Ned, what kind of like extraneous stuff is involved when you're planning a unit?
I think, so there's different things, right? So we, you know, our system is based on the Common Core standards, right? And there are plenty of issues with that system itself. I think ultimately, like, it's probably a good idea to say, like, here are the things that kids are mostly going to learn about in first grade and second grade and so on, right? Like, that's a fine idea, right? But I think that the issue is that people have gone so far into this, like, you know, how will you know they've mastered this standard? And how will you know they've mastered this standard, right? How will you know they've mastered every single standard? And I'm like, they won't, right? They won't. And a lot of people in education, you know, you say something like that, and they're like, you have low expectations for kids. No, like, I have realistic expectations for learning.
Yeah.
Like, what I expect is that kids are going to engage in a thoughtful way in learning about and doing and talking about math, right? Like, that's what I ultimately care about. There's no standard that's inherently valuable, right? It's not inherently valuable to learn the standard algorithm for multiplication, right? That's a tool, but it's a standard. And so I have to teach the standard, right? And so within that system, then there's often like all of the stuff around like, well, when are you teaching this standard? How are you going to know? Like all of these other things. And so the way that I see people using like Magic School or other tools is to like, say, I need a lesson, you know, that uses this curriculum and put in there how it meets the standard, put in there how it does this other thing. And that's kind of the like, just the nonsense of it, right? Like the box checking.
Okay. So you mentioned this Magic School program, some of your colleagues using that for planning. And it, I guess, does it also kind of automate some other stuff that you have to do as a teacher, or?
I don't really know. I've mostly seen people use it for like lesson planning.
Okay.
I was in a district professional development for math, for fifth grade math teachers. And, you know, they wanted us to do this thing where we're like looking at the curriculum and we always have to do this like internalization, right? Is what the big buzzword for planning is, you know, internalize the standards, internalize the lesson, whatever it is, right? Like that's the work, right? That really is the work. But also every single year we go to the same PD with the same people and do the same task, right? And like,
quickly, Nick, what does internalize mean? What does internalize mean? Because I'm kind of like, I know what it means to me, but I'm not sure if my meaning is the same as your meaning.
Yeah, I would say it's just like you really understand what the standard is asking kids to know and be able to do.
Right. Okay.
So it always involves like doing the fifth grade math yourself, right? It involves like thinking about strategies that you would use and that you would think that kids would use and that you would want kids to use, all of those kinds of things. Like I said, there's value in it, although it's like, again, everything, if there's anything in education that is worth doing, the system thinks it's worth killing or overdoing, right?
Yeah.
You know, so we're sitting there and I'm sitting next to this guy who just takes the thing we're asked to do, feeds it into, I think he was using Gemini, and then says, like, do this for me. And it like it spits out this thing. And then he's like, okay, now like create a poster that shows all of this information. And like he handed his computer to someone else who then replicated the poster on a piece of paper. And I did not know what to do in that situation. Like as soon as he started doing it, I was just like, oh my God, like this, wow, he's really going to do that. And then I just like grayed out and was like, I can't even watch this happen. This is so, and then the facilitator is coming over and is like, oh, that's really cool. Like tell everybody else how you did that.
Oh, and I'm like, God.
He didn't do anything.
Exactly.
isn't that the opposite? So you're asked to internalize something, and in fact, they externalize it.
Yeah.
Because all they really want you to do is complete the task.
Right.
Because they're ticking boxes.
Correct. Right.
It's ticking boxes all the way down.
All we need is a product. It does not matter how you get the product, as long as you have the product.
Amazing. I remember being asked to show my work in school, but I guess that's just the legacy way of doing things. I don't know.
That's correct. I ask kids to do it every day.
So are you seeing any AI being deployed like in the classroom itself?
So a couple things I've seen. One is it has crept into Google, just keeps sticking Gemini into everything, right? And so yeah. Because we have Gemini Enterprise or whatever in our district, all of a sudden now when you go to Google Slides, it's like, beautify this slide with Gemini, like all that kind of stuff, right? It's in Google Classroom. I don't even know what it's supposed to be doing in Google Classroom. It's very, very unclear to me. Like all I'm doing is giving kids an assignment and they're doing the assignment. I'm not sure what something else would do. So the way that our district has implemented AI is to implement like Magic School for Teachers, Gemini for Teachers. And then there are a couple of programs that teachers are told they should use with students. One is called Brisk, which is it's sort of like a feedback thing for writing. So you put in your rubric, whatever, kids do the assignment, it grades it based on the rubric. And not only that, but there's like a chatbot part of that. But my understanding, I haven't had any personal experience with it. I only know some people who have, but like my understanding is that the chatbot part, you have to put in questions that you think kids will ask, and then like responses to those questions, whether those are answers or like prompts for further thinking or whatever else. And again, under the guise of like save time, right? Like just have the chatbot answer these questions that you know kids are going to ask. And once again, like, but why, right? That's the entire job of teaching, right? The entire job is like working with kids on their writing and having them work with each other on their writing. And like, why would we, I get why the VC company that owns Brisk wants kids to only learn from the chatbot. I don't get why an educator would think it's okay for kids to learn from the chatbot instead of from them or from each other or whatever it is. But it's sort of the roided up version of what I was describing earlier. You get a bunch of kids in a dark room all on their devices, mm-hmm. and they only have to interact with the device and not each other. They're not going to learn shit from that.
Yeah.
They might produce a piece of writing. And if that's all you care about is the production of a piece of writing, okay. But like, they're not learning anything.
Yeah. And we've talked about on the show, like quite a few times, this desire to reduce humans to our output.
Yep.
And then, you know, you can just automate the human away, and that's better for everybody. Well, except the humans being automated away. But when you're talking about, and I love the image you use there of the kids sitting alone in a darkened classroom, their faces alight by the glow of their screens. Have you read about this Alpha School thing?
Oh yeah.
There was a big article in Wired about this, and I'll just quickly summarize for anybody who hasn't read about it, but we'll put the article in the show notes. But basically, it's this like AI school startup, and they have this idea that you can do, what is it, like 2 hours a day of learning, and you learn all of the stuff that, you know, kids would in a normal day. And the way they do it is as you've just described, the kids have a device and they have comfy chairs and they go, you know, learn from the device, and there are no human teachers necessary. I guess they have some kind of teaching assistant, you know, one TA for however many kids wandering around just in case the machine doesn't teach you. But yeah, I mean, what's your take on that whole nonsense?
You know, my entire career, like, everyone is always looking for ways to have fewer teachers, right?
It's
just been a thing, right? I don't know if you're familiar with John Hattie. He's an Australian researcher, and he wrote this book on the gist is about, like, effect sizes and the effect size on different sorts of interventions on student learning. And administrators love to bring that shit out, because his analysis found that smaller class sizes actually doesn't have really any meaningful effect on education. There's all these, like, super highlight cherry pick things. That's always the biggest one, is like, you say you want smaller class sizes, but John Hattie's research found that it doesn't actually matter. And there are all these, like, mathematical issues with his,
sure.
It's like a meta-analysis kind of thing. And he basically just, like, invented some math to, like, fudge some numbers. But, like, people in education don't understand math or statistics or anything like that, which is a lot of the reason why we have the systems that we do, right? Our understanding of data is horrendous. You know, it's always like, what's this kid going to know 2 weeks from now? How is this score going to be better a week from now? I'm like, well, it probably isn't. Nothing's going to be different a week from now. You're talking about, like, 4 hours worth of learning in a week. Like, nothing's going to be meaningfully different. Like, let's talk in 6 months, right? But we love to use all these statistical fallacies, right? We love tiny sample sizes. We love made up numbers that fit our narrative, like, all that kind of stuff is
imaginary numbers. They're called imaginary numbers. I thought you were a math teacher.
I only got to fifth grade. But you don't get into that.
So is it a bit like everyone's like working like a stock market CEO now, looking at the next, not even the next quarter, but the next, you know, the next week, the next month, rather than the next quarter or 6 months?
Oh yeah, everything is like, you know, what are you going to bring back next week? And I'm like, I will bring back something next week, right? Because we will continue this learning and whatever. But I'm not expecting, like, things to be meaningfully different, right? There will be some kids that, like, when we go to the next level of this particular standard, right, we'll go, oh, now I get how this works, right? And then they've mostly got it, right? But again, we need to have, like, longitudinal data, and we don't really care about that. And I truly believe it's because people just don't understand really how numbers work.
Right, yes. The other thing I was going to ask you about, sort of like, you know, you were talking about this concept of, like, talking to the chatbot. I mean, the thing that I know about chatbots is that they're kind of status quo machines, essentially. They're based on, like, stuff we already have. If people are inventive or if people are creative, then this thing will kind of, like, it won't bring it out. I think it will kill it, actually. And so I don't know if you feel like that, like, where do you feel like people are slightly outside of the sort of status quo box are going to fit in this sort of chatbot world? Because I fear for that kid, you know?
I think that's an issue with the system and with the standards and all of that in general, right? Like, that's the real issue, is it can just flatten everything out.
Yeah, but you're there to intervene, is what I mean. You know, there are kind of like human beings in the system now that will intervene for those kids, you know?
Yes. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of educators have been taught that really you just have to get kids to meet the standard, right? And so, especially if you're talking about writing or things like that, I mean, sorry to my colleagues, but they're like, I've worked with people who a chatbot would not be meaningfully worse than their teaching in writing. Right. Oops. And like I don't really mean that as a dig, right? I mean that as, like, they've been taught to teach writing in a way that can be replicated by a machine.
Right. Okay.
Because all it is you have to write a 5-paragraph essay, and here's what that looks like, right? It has to, you know, your introduction has to start with a hook, right? That's a question that's like, have you ever thought about orcas? You know, and so writing for a lot of people is taught that way, right? When I was teaching writing, I'd be like, but this is boring, right? Like, let's, like, what do you really want to write about? Like, let's go, you know, like we can do the things that you have to do. We can, you know, you can cite your sources and provide evidence and all those other things, but like, be interesting about it, right? And we're already teaching writing in a way that's so formulaic. I don't know how big a difference it actually makes in this context.
Yeah, I was reading something, I think Cory Doctorow wrote, where he was talking about freshman composition class at university. And he said, the first thing we do is teach people to stop with the 5-paragraph essay, because it's just bullshit, you know, box ticking, no child left behind, you know, nonsense.
Yep.
But back to this idea of wanting to basically reduce staff or enlarge classes or, you know, whatever, have fewer annoying unionized teachers, I guess, in the workplace. Mm-hmm. Have you seen administrators actually start using AI as like an excuse for lowering staffing?
No, I haven't personally seen it. I haven't heard about it happening anywhere yet.
Okay.
Other than this, that one very specific example that is designed about not having teachers, but that actually is something we're working towards making sure never happens. I'm on the bargaining team for my union, and we are currently trying to bargain some safety measures about AI. And so that's, you know, a process. We have been in bargaining for about 2.5 months, and we proposed a whole lot of language about AI sort of comprehensively, you know, sort of asking for, you know, we proposed things like a joint AI steering committee that would have district appointed members and union appointed members who would like work on AI policy in the district and things like that.
So the district doesn't have an AI policy yet, or your school doesn't have one?
No, well, sort of. We learned through the process they actually had a lot more things already in place than we thought as far as like their procedures and things like that. But that information was not widely shared. There actually already is an AI steering committee that is district created, right? And when they presented to us on their current policies and the committee, they made sure to mention that all of the educators that are on the committee are members of the union. And we clarified that, of course, that's different than having people appointed by the union to represent the union, right? Not every person represents the overall interest of the union, even if they're a member. But they actually, you know, they had some pretty good procedures in place, some I think, like pretty reasonable guardrails and things like that, a term that I'm really coming to hate.
Yeah.
Really getting tired of hearing about guardrails, but because they're mostly bullshit, and a guardrail doesn't actually prevent a truck from crashing through it. You know, it's sort of the illusion of safety in a lot of cases. But their procedures were pretty good. They had a thoughtful vetting process. Any implementation of AI was going to go through this whole process. The guy who's in charge of that for the district was, you know, talked about when, I think it was the, you know, that they were trying to use it for the military, and whichever company backed out of like allowing the government to.
Oh, Anthropic.
Right. Yeah. So when they backed out of that, right. So he was kind of talking about like, here's this example of things being done in like an unsafe way. Like, here's how it's different for us. And I was like, well, you know, I mean, I'm thrilled to hear that there are actually like some procedures in place and it's not just like willy nilly. And so we said, cool, maybe you do want to just put that in the contract. And they were like, no.
The other thing that, from a programming perspective, from a developer's perspective, people who are using the chatbots, I think you were mentioning it earlier on, actually, Nate, is that Gemini owns your thoughts. And this is something that worries me as a sort of a developer, is that not necessarily, well, obviously it's annoying that it owns your thoughts, But what's more annoying to me is that in owning them, it's surveilling you. And I know in like software development, at least, there are tools that the management can use to see, for example, how many prompts did, how much like usage, how much spend.
Yeah, tokens, yeah.
How much, yeah, I don't want to get technical, but how much spend did a programmer have with his chatbot this month? So how much spend? And then also, like, how many of the suggestions that the AI gave were actually accepted by the developer? And obviously from, you can see where it's all going, you know, that the if you spend more, then this is somehow good, weirdly. And if you accept more, then that's also good because, you know, you're doing less. Again, somehow good. I don't know. Because you, anyway, is this kind of thing happening in your space as well? This kind of surveillance and monitoring and this kind of stuff?
Unclear. The district would say that it's not happening. I don't trust any of these systems, right? And so, like, I'll trust the people at the district who are, you know, that I'm bargaining with. It's our chief information officer, right, is one of the people on the team. And he talks a lot about, you know, well, these are safe because they're closed systems, right? These aren't just open systems. These are closed systems that are only for APS and all these other things. But I keep saying, like, but ultimately then you're trusting Google to like keep that information safe. And Google has shown over and over and over again that like not only do they not care about keeping it safe, like in many instances they're aggressively not keeping it safe. And they're like, but you know, we have these guardrails, we have these like safety agreements and you know, like these are all like legal protections. And I'm like, but if kids' data gets out there, it doesn't matter what legal ramifications are because it's out there, right? The thing has already happened.
Yeah, yeah.
Are we really going to sue Google over this? Like, right? And even if we do, that doesn't get the data back, right? That doesn't get the privacy back. Like, none of those things, none of that is ever remediated. Legal remediation shouldn't be the answer to any of this.
Yeah, they seem to be very happy, like, to... It's a bit like gun violence over there. Everyone like has thoughts and prayers. Very sorry about that. We'll try and make sure that doesn't happen again. You know, the OpenAI people talk about like, oh, you know, it's very sad that these people commit suicide, but a lot of people get a benefit, so let's not worry about it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's wild.
So how is that bargaining process going? Or is that still ongoing or did you get a contract yet?
Still going. We are essentially down to really this year, the only things we're bargaining are compensation, which we bargain every year. And then some things about some plan time. There's a little bit of ongoing negotiation about that. And then AI. And that is sort of the entirety of negotiations this year. And some years there's more than others, but that's just kind of how it went this year. Feel like we're pretty close to agreement on the compensation and plan time parts. Really not sure what's going to happen with the AI stuff. Like I said, we proposed a ton of language at the beginning that, you know, like we kind of cobbled together from some different sources and, you know, there's a lot of like legalese in it and some things that were sort of repetitive and, but they came back with, you know, I think we proposed like 14 pages worth of language, which is a ton, right? And our contract is only like, our collective bargaining agreement is maybe, I don't know, 65 pages or something like that. So 14 pages of new language is a ton.
Right.
And also like, that's the place to start, right? Like there are a lot of things to think about, like, you know, in bargaining, some things are going to get cut down and whatever, right? They came back with a single page that basically said like,
we're going to use it. Fight us.
Basically, yes. You know, wouldn't even include some of the specific language about current practice, any of those things. When we pressed on those or asked questions about that, they said things like, well, this technology moves really fast.
I fucking hate that.
Yeah. Yeah. So we can't put it in the contract because, you know, who knows what we're going to have to change suddenly. And we can't just change the contract. Yeah, like, And one of the people on their team said, you know, well, this language could become outdated. And I said, all this language does is say, like, it's going to get used thoughtfully. Nobody's data is going to be at risk. Nobody will be required to use AI. None of that can become outdated, right? Like, right. That's just nonsense. So that's been a little bit frustrating. We re-presented some language to them this past week. They will be presenting their counter to that tomorrow. So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, I wonder if they're using chatbots to write their one-page summary.
Would not surprise me at all. You know, I was thinking about the, you know, you guys had the episode where you talked about the different like tiers of people in AI.
The programmers, how to talk to programmers.
Yeah. And I was thinking how the parts of that apply to just users, right?
Yeah.
There are definitely some people that are like, no, this is like objectively good and people should be using it, right? That's the vibe from some of the people in district leadership. You know, I don't think it should be a huge ask to say no educator has to use it and you can't use it in evaluations, which are like our two biggest asks. And they keep pushing back on that. And I'm like, that sucks.
So evaluations.
We're talking about teacher evaluations.
Teacher evaluations. Okay. Yeah. So when your boss writes an evaluation of you as a teacher,
correct,
they should write that themselves as a human being and not, gotcha.
Yes. That's what we're asking for. And, you know, I said the same thing that I said about my planning. I said, this is the work of being an evaluator, right? And if you are giving evaluators too much work to do so that they feel like they have to cut corners on an educator's evaluation, you're devaluing the process, right? And you're acknowledging that you're giving people too much to do. Just give people less to do.
Is it because they want to make it easier to get rid of teachers? Is that the bottom line?
I don't think so. I think, contrary to a lot of popular belief, it's not actually hard to get rid of a bad teacher.
Right.
You just actually have to do the work as the evaluator, which again isn't that hard, but you have to do it. And you know, there's always been this big narrative about how bad teachers just sit around and you can't fire them and blah 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 blah. Like, it's actually not that difficult at all. Like, even my union is strong, right? We have a strong union. We have a strong collective bargaining agreement, a lot of correct protections for educators and things like that, and it is still entirely possible to get rid of people. Now, if you're asking if they want to make it easier, probably, right? Because a lot of people who are evaluators, they want the, you know, like in every field, they want the fun parts of being the boss or the parts that they enjoy about being the boss, but nobody really wants to be the boss when it comes time to really get after people, right? Or to really like get people to do their jobs or whatever it is, right? And so I think there are surely people that would make it easier if they could on themselves.
What's the general, like, it's interesting that you mentioned that how to talk to programmers episode, because I'm kind of, you know, now I'm wishing for an education podcast that does a kind of how to talk to educators episode, because I think like it's really important. And this is one thing that my friend was telling me about, how they've kind of worked with their colleagues to try and plant some of the arguments, or not even plant, try and make some of the arguments against using, you know, this generative AI especially. So I'm just wondering, like, you know, you mentioned the poster that you put up, or the addendum you put up to the poster or whatever. Are there other things that you or any of your kind of Luddite colleagues have been doing to try and spread the word about some of the negative aspects of this technology?
Definitely. You know, like I said, you have to finesse it, right? I'm trying to, you know, when is the time it comes up with a colleague that somebody says something about it, they can be like, hey, you know, right? Because, you know, people are using these things again because like they think it's going to save them time, or they think it's, you know, and so it's always amazing to me, like, how little so many people know about so many things. I understand like people have different media diets and whatever else, right? But like, I, you know, I'm on Blue Sky and Instagram are the social media things that I'm on, and I see AI things every single day, right? every single time I'm on there, I see something about how bad AI is.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I understand that's how algorithms work. And you know, if I'm always looking at things about how bad AI is, then I will get more of that on Instagram anyway.
Yeah.
You know, blue sky, I follow who I follow, but I follow a lot of people who are against AI. So
yeah,
I guess that's why I see that. I think, you know, I also printed out and folded and distributed in the staff lounge some anti-AI zines.
Cool. DIY stuff. Love it.
Yep. Yeah, I'm sure you guys have seen the one that I printed because it was going around Blue Sky a lot. Like every couple weeks I see it pop up again. But it's pretty good. Talks about all the downsides and all those things. And I like put them out just in a public place and watched them like disappear like one at a time. So it's not like somebody just like swept them all into the trash. Like people were just kind of taking it and looking at it, and had some people come to me and say, like, did you leave these in the lounge? And I sure did. You got any questions? And they're like, no, it's really interesting. I was like, glad to hear that. I also, I mean, on my bargaining team, there's a colleague who the first time we had any conversation, I actually joined the bargaining team this year because they said they were going to bargain about AI.
Oh, great.
And they said, we're desperately looking for some members. Here's what we're bargaining. And I was like, that's how they get you. You know, we're going to talk about AI and elementary plan time. And like, those are two things that I would like to talk about. So
like a moth to a flame.
Exactly. I'm like, I can't not. But, you know, the first time we talked about it on the team, one of my colleagues said, basically, it's inevitable. So like, we just have to, you know, learn about it and learn how to use it. And I said, I disagree. And here's why. And actually that first session, all I did was share some zines with them. And I said, I don't think it's inevitable. I think there are lots of arguments against it. And like, that's really all I want to say about it for now. But please like take these and look at them and like maybe research some of the sources that are printed on the back of it. Mm-hmm. And people did. And this one person in particular was like, said several weeks later, you know, how do we give people the experience that I had where, like, I came in here saying like it's inevitable and we're gonna have to learn how to use it and we're gonna have to do it. And now I'm like, no AI. I'm like, oh my God, that's amazing, right? Like how often do you actually get to have that opportunity where somebody really like takes that in and like, so that was like very rewarding. And also like, all right, how do we expand that, right? How do we get that information to other people? How do we like make sure that other people like really get to hear that?
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, Nate, we've been talking for a while and really appreciate hearing, you know, these things from your experience and so on. Is there any kind of last thing you'd like to leave the audience with before we wrap up?
For sure. I think one thing that will really help with this, you know, right now we're trying to do this through bargaining, which I think is a good way to do it, right? To get some things in our contract. And like, not enough people know, right? And people that know don't really know how to go about being against AI, right? Or changing things, you know? And I think like the thing I'd ultimately say, are you guys familiar with Dr. Tressie McMillan Cottom?
Not yet, but please enlighten us and we'll put that in the show notes.
Yeah, she's a sociologist and a professor in North Carolina. She writes for the New York Times. I think she's incredible. I just saw again this video she'd posted of herself and you know, she's two things that she said that I think you guys have talked about a lot, but I really like the way she said them. One was she was talking about the idea of AI is inevitable, and she says, if you can get me to believe that, then I will behave as if it is already true. And then like the other part was, she said, she talked about how she chooses to refuse, she rejects this idea that the future is already settled. And the quote that I think is really beautiful is, she says, refusing is the more hopeful, expansive vision of the future than the one that is telling us that the future is already settled and decided. I think that's awesome. And I think that like, that inspires me to like, again, join the bargaining team and like try to get some protections, right? But I think for people who care about education and care about kids, like, first of all, refuse on your own, right? But then like, if you're a parent, like, make sure you know what their tech policies are in your kid's school, right? How do you opt your kids out of things you don't want them to be doing? Like, people have to get loud about this. Like, that's the only way to, like, affect that change in a system like a school system, right? Where, like I said, like, the creep has happened, right? The technology creep has happened over decades, right? And it's kind of a tipping point kind of situation, right? But, like, people have the power to say no to it. Like, you can go to your kid's school, you can go to the school board of the district you're in, right? And say, like, what is your policy? Like, why is my kid being told they have to use AI? Whatever it is, right?
Right.
But I think, like, students and educators really need that support, and find whatever opportunity you can to, like, be against the things you're against.
Fantastic. Yeah, I love that. Anthony Moser, who is on the second episode of this season, actually wrote a letter to his kid's school protesting some AI stuff. So we have that up on our website. And maybe the zines you mentioned, we'll definitely put them in the show notes. And, you know, if they're licensed appropriately, we can add those to the website too. Because I think just getting resources that folks can use, whether they're parents or educators like yourself, to share with colleagues, I think that's a really powerful way to resist. Nate, thank you again. This was a great conversation. It was delightful to meet you, and we really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you guys so much.
Yeah, thanks, Ned. This is that bit at the end where we thank you for listening to this episode of Polytechs. First, we hope you enjoyed the show, and we really appreciate the time you've given to this subject. If you want to follow up with us, please send email to podcast@polytechs.dev, because that's very direct and doesn't have any algorithms. If you prefer social media, we're at Polytechs on Blue Sky and at Polytechs at mastodon.social. We're not on Twitter for obvious reasons. To help the show reach a wider audience, please share it with your friends, family, and colleagues. There's nothing as good as a real human recommendation. You can find out more about the show on the website, which is polytechs.dev. As you should expect, there are no cookies or tracking of any kind. All the show notes, transcripts, and contact details are over there. If you want to show a deeper level of commitment, there's also an option to donate. We're passionate about free and open access to the episodes, so there's no obligation and there are no benefits other than a warm feeling in your heart. Finally, we would really appreciate a 5-star review on your podcast platform. Reading positive reviews makes us feel good and can help others find the show and make them feel like it's worth their time. Okay, that's all the admin done, and we hope to see you next week. Bye!